Welcome to the Fair Parenting Podcast, where we cover people's stories, ideas, and the progress towards fair parenting.
Welcome to the podcast. This is episode 50. I never thought we'd get here, but we have. Okay, so as we do with every set of 10 episodes, we're going to do a retrospective episode. And so here's a run through of what we looked at in episodes 41 to 49. Episode 41 was looking at Britain's NHS banning blockers. This week, Britain banned the NHS, which is its National Public Health Service, from prescribing harmful puberty blockers to children. Those blockers obviously stop their physical development. Without going into the reasons why people do this, and without going into politics and the story more deeply, I don't want to do that. I just want to look at the parenting aspects and the change aspects, the social change. Basically, to just clarify, I'm not involved in the debate about blockers. And to me, it seemed, perhaps because I'm not involved in it, that the change came out of the blue. And also looking at the media, it seemed that some people were surprised, some commentators were surprised that this was announced. I don't know what led up to it, but I'll bet it didn't come out of the blue, and I'll bet a lot of hard work was involved. In my view, the ban on blockers has protected many children and given hope to others that change can happen in other areas. The people involved in both sides of that blocker ban would have had entrenched vested interests, just as we see in family law. That change happened in the face of entrenched vested interests gives us hope. One additional problem we face in changing family law is the amount of money they spent on lawyers, including legal aid lawyers, plus all the other experts that make their living in family law. And I say experts, obviously they are of varying quality. Many of those experts and lawyers will resist change to family law. I spoke more about vested interests and incentives in episode 37. History is made up of tides. Maybe the tide is changing in ways that can help children, and hopefully it will happen with family law too. And I believe the ban is, not in every case, but in the main, positive. Episode 42 was looking at the protests that were happening at the time about the Garrick Club in London. So it's an exclusive club and not everyone can go there. I'm pretty sure I can't. I presume the club has always only allowed men. However, the fuss seems to have arisen in the last week, when lawyers and MPs have been protesting that women should be allowed. There are many women-only clubs in Britain. Gender-only clubs have an appeal for their members, otherwise they wouldn't exist. It can be debated both ways, whether they're good or bad, or should be allowed or should not be allowed. The problem is that what they complain about won't be solved by letting women into the Garrick Club. It will likely just shift elsewhere. People will mix with who they want to mix with. If men want a men-only club or women want a women-only club, they will find or form one. Whether the club or any club should be allowed to restrict on gender is not the point of this episode. The point of the episode is focus, is the focus of the protesters. On the face of it, the argument for equality is a strong one. Although there are other single-sex clubs, as we've mentioned, and other exclusive places such as golf, country clubs, spas, other clubs and associations. Strikingly, the protesters about the Garrick Club seem to have a large proportion of lawyers and MPs. These people must regularly see horrendous and harmful inequality for their clients and constituents. Where are their protests for that? What they are focusing on says much. Now, maybe the protesters do support equality causes, and from time to time we see this in the media, so I'm not saying they are terrible and they don't support inequality causes, but what they're currently focusing on and whipping up a lot of publicity about is far down the list of issues important to the public. It would be good to see lawyers and MPs come together over equality issues and causes that affect normal people more often and with the same vigour. Most of the public cannot join the Garrick Club. With this issue, the protesters do not seem to seek inclusivity for all. They seem to seek to join an exclusive club themselves. It seems to be a case of it being about them, not us. They are focusing on a molehill in a valley surrounded by mountains that better deserve their attention if public interest is paramount. Once this storming of teacup is over, these lawyers and MPs with their out-of-proportion views will be in court and parliament making decisions in a more hidden way, and their out-of-proportion views may affect us, but we won't necessarily know so much about it. At least this week their silliness is visible and a light has been shone on it. And that is all I have to say, really. They are eminent people and their focus is misplaced. And they seem to lack self-awareness of this. What the protesters are focusing on says much when there is greater injustice all around for lawyers and MPs to do something about. In short, they should have better things to spend their time on that would help more people with bigger problems. And those people are the general public. And we need our lawyers and MPs to be doing better than this. Episode 43 was in our replay series in which I look back at favourite episodes. This one was my chat with Dr. Marnie Hill Fodorero, in which she discussed parental alienation, and it's one of my favourite ever episodes.
Very much so. Gaslighting and isolation, smearing. There's just so many strategies that these people use.
Yes.
And, you know, that's something that I never knew about. And I had to do a lot of research to look into what was this, what is domestic violence? What is narcissistic abuse? What is parental alienation? I didn't even know. But boy, when I started to learn and connect the dots, and then in addition, do my own intergenerational family trauma work, you know, look back on my own, you know, upbringing and what made me someone with weak boundaries or someone who was a people pleaser or who would ignore yes. bad behavior for all these years. I had to look at myself and see my role in how this all played out, which is very different than the alienators. They don't look at themselves. They're always pointing the finger at others,
yeah.
Blaming others, but they also do not look into themselves and want to change because they don't think anything is wrong with them, where it's the empathetic, loving parent that always is trying to look at what is in the best interest of the kids and you know, what is my role in all of this with the dynamics, you know? So it you know, the researchers, and there are top researchers in parental alienation, like Dr. Amy Baker, Dr. Jennifer Harmon, Dr. Craig Childress. There's a number of other people that, you know, speak on parental alienation. I, you know, just with my books, I'm contributing just a small part to the large amount of research and references and tools and, you know, resources for people to understand this kind of dynamic.
So much of what you said resonated with my own story about the gaslighting and not realizing that it was happening to you. Or, you know, in my case, I knew that the behaviors I was experiencing were just wrong, but I didn't have the knowledge at that stage to say, hang on, I'm being coercively controlled, I'm being gaslit, and things, you know, I tried to address the behaviors of my abuser as if they were a rational person, and it just doesn't work.
No. You cannot be rational with people that are irrational. You cannot think like a criminal when you are not a criminal.
Yes.
And these people are extremely malevolent. The damage is devastating and it is long lasting, and it's very detrimental to the children. In fact, in so many cases, you know, there are studies that are showing that there's a generational component to this, so that, you know, you've been alienated from your children. You had to go back and look, maybe even in your own family or extended family, there was some alienation going on, or at least some gaslighting and bad mouthing or indirect, like under the guise lies of care. Well, I really care about you, but so I'm going to tell you these bad things, but don't tell anyone else. You know, so these abusers all kind of follow the same playbook. But yeah, it's a devastating dynamic, and you know, it's very hard to have reuniting, you know, results as after experiencing this. And it also helps us realize that we're not alone, that there are others that are going through this. And so our voices matter because you can hear different perspectives on how other people are coping with this.
At the time, yes, you just cannot believe the level of projection that's going on. It's
unbelievable. They accuse you. It's like they're looking in a mirror and accusing you of exactly what they're doing. And then if we continue to choose to live in light and love, you know, we're not fighting fire with fire.
No.
Because that's not how we're wired. We're loving good people. It doesn't even cross our minds to hurt other people. But that's not how everyone else is wired or how they operate. And so that's a rude awakening. And sometimes it takes these significant trauma situations like parental alienation or some of the losses that, you know, you've experienced when you leave a toxic, it's not even just a toxic individual, it's an abusive individual. We can have toxic people in our lives that are not abusive, but what we're talking about here is true abusive people.
What you said about going back and examining your own childhood, and I think at the start of our conversation, you mentioned boundaries and that you'd learned boundaries in childhood, and that may have contributed to things taking so long for you to realize in your marriage. And I think that's probably true for me. But I mean, it shows great perspective and wisdom and willingness to examine history. For you to actually have gone back and done that work, because you know, a lot of people would bury it or not want to confront it at all. But you've actually done quite a lot of reflection there and have got some, you know, very profound learnings.
Well, I think you have to with any kind of adversity or challenges. I think, you know, it does take a certain maturity level, or it takes a certain kind of timing to be able to go back and really look at your role in things and make some adjustments where needed. Like, I've had to put up some healthier boundaries with not letting people in my life.
Yes.
And some not keeping people in my life, you know, that I've been trauma bonded to. And I think the research is key. And that's where my books come in, as just, you know, one of many resources that are out there to just provide that kind of knowledge and awareness of what you're dealing with. Because, you know, once you realize what you're dealing with, it helps you accept it more or come to terms with it more, you know, or be able to just, you know, cope and be able to have days where you're happy and fulfilling your life purpose and that type of thing, you know, getting back to, you know, reclaiming your own life.
Especially if you're unawares and you're perhaps a little bit naive about things, and you want to believe that everything's just and good, but you can get sucked into a realization that is just unsettles you so much that you might not climb out of it again in one piece, and you can really suffer in these situations. And the speed of the course is another problem, because you can be in this situation for years.
I'm still in court. I filed in 2013.
Yeah.
And then this particular last petition situation, which is, you know, filled with lies and false documents and all of that, which is really getting overlooked. What the gist of the whole thing is it's a continuation of domestic abuse. It's you know, you would think that you know, that could be very clear to the court system. Like, why would they still be back in court after all these years? And, but that's gone on for over a year, and it's, you know, and it's just money, and, you know, they want you frazzled, they want you, you know, they want you just to get so exhausted and worn out that you'll just agree to anything, even if it's not in the best interest of the child, or even if it's not fair and it's based on lies, you know.
Mm. In the beginning, I thought the behavior was so bad that I was a victim of, I just thought, well, we're going to get into court and they're going to see this and it's going to be be over in 5 minutes. what an idiot, you know. But that's what you kind of believe growing up. The steps you've taken shows how you've evolved past the stage where a lot of us are in. We're still in the trenches, mentally and physically and emotionally, and maybe some of us will never get out of that. But I think, you know, what you're doing is you are giving an example to many others of what we can hope to get to at some stage.
But actually, just talking about it, Phil, is already turning the corner. Because having these candid conversations where they're long and in-depth and very thoughtful but very informative, that can help, you know, promote other people to think about, well, maybe I should get out of the trauma a little bit and balance this out a little bit more. And they might not have without hearing your podcast or this conversation.
The way you've evolved and the fact that you're sharing your story is really an example of shining a light that can help so many of us, because there are so many people who are really on the first footsteps of this journey, and hearing stories like yours, I think, you know, it's just so powerful.
Right. And you know, it is a journey, you know, so I was where you were at. And I think we go through all the different stages in our understanding and evolving when it comes to this. So, and you did bring up a great point that, you know, we want to be whole for our children. We have to really realize, though, our children are being abused. This is severe, extreme child abuse.
Yes.
And so they, just like we are traumatized and will have to go through various stages of grief and understanding, they are traumatized too. And you know, it's going to be a long journey for them to get, you know, life will never be the same. I mean, unfortunately, you know, you can't go back and just pretend that this didn't happen. And that's a tough reality, because, you know, you as a loving parent, the last thing you want to do is see your child abused and not being able to protect them from that.
As a society, I think we need to know about parental alienation, and also we need to be able to spot it when it's being done to our friends, so that as a society we can actually start to, in a way, other things are now frowned at. For example, drink driving or smoking indoors. You know, you wouldn't, if you see a parent smoking in a car with children, that's not acceptable these days. And I think if we can get to the stage where parental alienation and psychological abuse of partners is just not tolerated in society, then I think that's going to, well, it will just affect so many lives.
Right. And, you know, we're bringing awareness just by having these conversations. You know, years and years ago, I know a Dr. Richard Warshak, who wrote Divorce Poison, you know, he also wrote a children's book, you know, regarding parental alienation years and years ago. And, you know, but now it seems that there's a name for it more, and that it is becoming more and more prevalent. And so, yes, awareness needs to be done, you know, where people are talking about this more and understanding. And there needs to be some resources for the younger aged kids.
Yes. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, the good thing is, as we discussed earlier, we because of social media, we can see it's happening in Australia and France and India and Canada and America and the UK. And that wouldn't have been possible 10 years ago or 20 years ago. So we are massively more aware than we were. And hopefully that this is just going to, you know, we don't want it to take 50 years to for society to address and stop this problem. Hopefully, you know, in this, the way technology moves, it's an exponential thing. And hopefully we can have an exponential progress with tackling parental alienation. But
right. Well, and also, you know, Dr. Craig Childress, he actually did a 7 or 9 video series for the alienated child. However, he is very scientific and psychological in his verbiage. And so it's really more for, you know, adult kids to read about. But there are books out there and videos out there that are directed at the child to help them understand, you know, what is going on, but certainly not a lot out there. So I think, you know, we're part of a movement that's just bringing awareness in the best way that we know how.
Episode 44 was looking at the term expert, and is it overused? Should it be used in many cases, and how it is used in the world and in the court system? Today, I want to look at the word expert, not so much in terms of family court, but more widely in its use in society. My view is the word expert is overused and overvalued and should be seen for what it often is. An educated guess that is often without accountability. The harm that experts do runs throughout society on every level. There are few people in life who really know what they're doing well enough to be able to advise the way experts do. In episode 11 of this podcast, Jody Gibson discussed trauma and how the training that experts have may not match our expectations. Some experts are not even trained in trauma, yet they see many people and report on many people who are suffering from it. Another example is in sports, very common. How often do we see on TV ex-players who have many trophies to their name predict wildly incorrect outcomes for a sports game? They make all kinds of predictions and forecasts and say things like, "I can't see any way for Team X to beat Team Y," only for that to happen moments later. It happens time and again, and it's so funny to see sometimes how people who have played at the highest level can get it so wrong. And yet, it illustrates perfectly the problem experts have. And it's done on national TV, so we get to see it with a level of scrutiny most experts don't receive. Another example is economics. The Federal Bank in the USA and the Bank of England in the UK, to name just two highly respected institutions, completely missed the boat on predicting the recent inflation surge. Transitory was a word used by those in charge, despite lay people and other experts saying otherwise. Still, the officials were the experts with the power. When they were proved to be behind the curve and wrong on inflation being transitory, it hurt millions of people who paid sharply increasing interest rates, with seemingly no consequence for the experts who got it wrong. Another example is lockdowns. Lockdowns and school closures are increasingly seen as causing lasting harm to children, yet experts were responsible for bringing them in. Follow the science, we were told, yet there are often experts on both sides and those in power have a choice as to which advice they follow when the views of experts can be polar opposites. I think sometimes experts are a way for officials to cover their backsides and pass the buck of responsibility, because they can always say later that they followed the experts. I think this can happen in court too and in other places. Another example is a COVID response. I don't want to get into the COVID debate too much, but giving COVID injections to children is increasingly seen as unwise and unnecessary. There were experts on both sides at the time, but only one set were listened to, with the others cast aside, cancelled, or just ignored. Another example, diesel cars to do with the environment. They were supposed to be great for the environment. We were incentivized to buy them. That's no longer the case. The expert advice has changed. Now experts say diesel is bad and buy electric. Another example, courts. We see experts in law on both sides of any available offence in family law and other branches of law. Another example is health. I've heard Tony Robbins say that with diagnosis, around 80% of second opinions differ from the first. So it's a really good idea to get that opinion, that second opinion, although it flies in the face of how society paints experts. We rarely consider how wrong experts can be, and the resulting cost of that to individuals and society. It's a great way for officials to pass the buck and avoid responsibility, and that may increase the use of experts. Last year, I heard Peter Diamandis say on his Moonshots podcast that for every expert, there is an equal and opposite expert. It's a great quote, and it's a great podcast. I often recommend the Moonshots podcast. It's brilliant. Decades ago, on the effects of smoking and the introduction of car seat belts, there are experts on both sides. This frequently can be the case and happens nowadays with the gender debate, the COVID response, education, and other examples I've talked about. They're frequently highly paid, well-qualified experts on both sides. Some of them, I think, are like lawyers. They're for rent, mercenaries. If their research came out with findings against the people paying them, would or could they be transparent and say that? Often experts are paid and the reports are used to influence in a particular direction. We cannot assume they are always independent or impartial, although often they will be. Let's have a look at a tool that experts often use, and that is computer modelling. Many experts use this. It sounds high tech and hard for a layperson to challenge, except when you see the results. Recently, we saw health models fail on COVID response, economic models fail on inflation, and let's not start on weather modelling, which we see fail quite regularly. We often see things repeat because fallibility and error were not examined properly, and there's little accountability. Does that sound familiar? Around 10 years later, in 2008, experts speculating on the housing market caused the global financial crisis. When experts get it wrong, public is often told lessons will be learned, but they rarely are, and how many people had any consequence at all, went to jail, etc., for that financial crisis. Yet, how many people lost their homes, their jobs, their lives as a result of those experts failing? Across the media, sports, finance, technology, and education, and many other areas, experts fail all the time, but little is learned. As a society, we don't question experts anywhere near as much as we should. I mean, we see this on TV as well. Reporters and TV presenters seem to take expert advice too willingly and with not enough questioning, in my view. Looking at examples and areas I've talked about, and also that there's many more, I think it's time that somebody wrote a book to widen or popularise knowledge about experts and how much we rely on them or overly rely on them, and to popularise knowledge of how often they fail and to make us a little bit more knowing about that as a society. I think this sort of thing should be taught in schools to foster critical thinking, which is something children should be taught. As a society, we don't seem good at addressing how little we and our experts really know. In some ways, our society is built on structures of perceived expertise. I think we would benefit from being a bit more critical and a bit more humble about experts and acknowledge that often we and they just don't know the answers. The sooner we reevaluate the position, capabilities, and fallibilities of experts, the better we will be, in my view. One way to counter having too much faith in experts is to re-term experts in court and all areas as fallible experts, or FEs. If we called experts fallible experts, that's not disrespectful, it's just acknowledging the reality. They are experts, but they can fail. Their advice can be wrong. I think if we did that, that alone would do much to change the perceptions across society. It will also lessen the burden of expectation on experts, and we need to realise that they often make mistakes and we should acknowledge it more. Just to sum up, my view is the word expert is simply overvalued and overused and should be seen for what it is in most cases, a guess that is often without accountability. Experts are often giving us an educated guess and not much more in many cases. Episode 45 was looking at paternity tests, not just how they affect men, but how they affect women and children And this was off the back of a recent story that had come to light where a judge had found out that his children weren't his, and this was many, many decades on from when they were born. Following a video clip of a judge that went viral recently, I want to talk about paternity testing today. An often quoted statistic is 10% of men are unknowingly bringing up children that aren't theirs. We don't know if that statistic is true, but it's often quoted. We have no way of knowing, really. To do that to another human seems like it should be a crime against the fooled parent and the child, for whom living a lie without knowing for decades that there was no biological link between them could cause indescribable harm. Yet it is common and there is no punishment. It seems like another gaping hole in the legal system. Obviously, courts can order paternity testing, but outside of legal proceedings, a parent should be able to choose to have a test if they want to. I think given how common paternity fraud is, it should be something offered to the fathers, or at least mentioned to them, either before the birth or at birth, so that they consider having it in the same way other health services are offered to people. Offering it as a free test to men may be a stretch for some, given where we are as a society. But even if a test has to be paid for, it's relatively cheap and is a good idea. After all, considering the risk, it's a low-cost test and can prevent significant mental health harm to parent and child and provide confidence from the start. It could be offered as a routine test, perhaps in confidence to men, as a way to possibly avoid any friction that may or may not happen between parents over the testing. As I say, it has mental health and physical health implications to the dad and the child, and I believe it's just good sense. There's even a child welfare reason to do it. Knowing the dad's health history may help doctors anticipate issues the child may face and may help diagnosis. If the dad is unknown, the biological dad, if that they are unknown or if they're incorrectly identified, this could cause complications. Also, there are laws where children who've been adopted can, there's a framework for them to find their biological parents later on. In these cases, again, as I say, it's a gaping hole in the system. You've got children who are being adopted through fraud. They're told their dad is their biological dad when that may not be the case. And so they never know that there's a biological dad out there who they may want to contact. It's something that really we need to look at as a society more. I believe this whole area is swept under the carpet. It's not dealt with properly in the health arena or the legal system, and it can open up dad and children to immense harm. In other cases, children may never find out, and the father may never find out either. It's very hard for children to find out, for example, if the mum or the dad are no longer around. It may make that more difficult. These days, as I've said, children are allowed to find birth parents if they've been adopted. By contrast, children who are not adopted may not be able to find out if the person they call dad actually is. Episode 46 was looking at documentaries and the pros and cons of them, and talking about mainstream media and new media. And this was after I received an approach from a documentary company. I was recently approached by somebody from a documentary maker about my story. I'm deciding whether to take part, but I'm often contacted by parents who want to get their stories out, and there's pros and cons to doing so, hence this episode. If any listeners want me to pass their details on to the person who contacted me, please DM or email me and I will. Some people will want to speak out and some won't. I discuss more about this balance in episode 14, which was Telling Your Story. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Documentaries also bring up some interesting points between old and new media. Many people say old media has had its day, with dwindling figures, editorial bias, limited time in which to tell a complex story, and stories being out of date by the time they're actually published or put on air. Social media is more direct and also not limited by time constraints. These days, as I've said, it can have better viewing figures too. And you can put your own story in your own words in as much space as you want. These days, MSM can seem to have more to do with clickbait than great journalism. Unfortunately, it just doesn't have the huge budgets for investigation that they once had. And I've heard many times older journalists mourn the state of their industry. That said, there are some great journalists still out there, and it is a valuable profession when it's done with integrity. There's probably a place for all formats, and I think that's true. And it's personal choice which one each one of us would want to do or not. Each form has its own audience, and there may be or may not be overlap, as some people don't read books, or some people don't listen to podcasts, and some people don't even watch TV anymore, so a documentary will be lost on them. Episode 47 was in the replay series. It was with Derek McDuff, looking back at one of the episodes from 2022, in which we discuss parenting and child separation in the movie Inception. And we also talk about other movies too. It's one of my favourite episodes, which is true of all the ones we highlight in the replay series. In episode 3, we talked to Derek McDuff about parent-child separation in the movies, specifically in Inception, but we also talk about other movies too.
I think that's why Nolan kind of chooses that as a subject in this movie, and, you know, at least one other movie that we're going to talk about, is that desire to get back to your children, because that is the most pure bond, like the love of a parent and a child, and the most, you know, there's nothing you can really do to destroy that, really. It's not like a relationship or something where, you know, someone can break up or whatever. It's like, that's for life. It's something that Spielberg touches on in Minority Report with Colin Farrell.
Yes.
He's talking to Tom Cruise, and he's like, parent losing a child is like the most, like, blah, 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 whatever he says. So I think on that level, it is something that is really obviously going to hit someone with kids and with in a similar situation in so much more of a profound manner.
Another really good film with Spielberg's around that time is AI. And that's almost a reverse, where it's the child wanting to get back to his mum. There's a really good scene. Again, I actually ought to do another episode. But there's a really good scene at the end where they bring his mother back, the aliens, but they can only do it for one day. And so he gets to spend one day with his mother. And that's poignant, you know, the way it's done. But anyway,
I was just going to say real quick, like, you could do a whole thing about Spielberg, because Spielberg, you know, being a child of divorce, he, like, almost every one of his movies, at least most of them, are like, have a bit of like divorce in them. Like Jurassic Park famously is like the grandkids are coming there after a divorce, and Alan Grant kind of is a disgruntled guy, doesn't want kids, and he learns how to be like a good father, and then that same arc repeats in like the next three Jurassic Park movies. And War of the Worlds is another one. Like, there's a lot of that in Spielberg. I think he just kind of copes with a lot of his being a child of divorce in his movies over and over again.
You know, there's early on, Cobb calls his children. They're asking about him, when is he coming back? And we hear the grandmother in the background telling the children he's never coming back. And he then asks to speak to the grandmother, and she hangs up on him. And there's that sense that the children are being cared for by an in-law who's hostile to the father. And he's finding it very difficult to even maintain a phone relationship with his children. Again, I think a lot of alienated parents can relate to that, because it's not always just the parents that alienate. Often they're helped by their, you know, relatives and friends, and it can seem as if you're up against a whole wall of opposition. And I really got that when I saw Cobb trying to talk to his children. I don't know too much about Christopher Nolan. I think he does have children, but I don't know what ages they are, or I don't know if he has experience at a family court. But there seemed to be, in at least a couple of his films, this idea of a parent being separated from a child. And I mean, it happens so much in the real world. It may be that, you know, a friend or relative went through it and he saw him the stress, or you know, who knows? But he does seem as something that he's very interested in, but I've never seen it written about.
Yeah, as far as I know, and I'm there is something I kind of want to touch on more on that with Interstellar, so I'll save some of my thoughts, but I do think it is that just kind of, yeah, it is the purest kind of just, you know, the love, even more than the reverse, a parent for their kids' love is just kind of the most, it's something that everyone can, like, understand as being a driving factor. You don't need to explain away why there is this love or anything. It's just implicitly there. You don't need to really give too much drive to that motivation. So I think that it is the most universal and understood kind of compassion and love, and, you know, why you would go through this entire thing. You know, like if you have something like in Star Trek, Wrath of Khan, when you see Kirk and Spock, when Spock dies,
yeah,
that means something to us because we have so many years of them being friends. And
yes,
if we just dropped into that movie, we'd be like, why do these guys care about each other so much? But you can kind of drop someone into, like, oh, this is my kid. You don't need like 15 seasons of a TV show. You can just be like, okay, we get it.
Right. Yeah. So we need to have gone on that journey with Kirk and Spock to know why, get the meaning. But you're saying with the parent and child, you don't need to. Yeah, I get that. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
When Moll commits suicide in real life, one thing she says that I'd missed before is she says she's going home to their real children because she actually believes that is the dream is her reality. And so there's another parental story there. She's killing herself because she wants to go home to her real children. Yeah, it's very powerful that she would actually do that to get back to them. But then she leaves, you know, once she's gone, she leaves Cobb in an unfortunate situation where he's at home with his children and there's some sort of assistant there, and he says to Cobb, it's now or never, and that's the last time Cobb sees his children until the very end. That's the point at which he flees America. You know, Inception becomes his only way back. When he finds this job, he knows that he's got two choices. He can do the job on the plane, at which point, once the job's complete, his name will get cleared by some sort of electronic means, or if the job fails, he's going to land. I think the words he uses is, if I complete this job and you don't honor your word, I'm going to jail for the rest of my life. Because there's a phrase used in Inception a couple of times about taking a leap of faith, and Cobb is doing that. He can live a free life outside of America, and probably quite a lucrative one with the skills that he has, but he wants so much to see his children, he embarks on this risky mission, and he recruits a team. It's a big endeavor, but at the end of the day, it comes down to a gamble. If he doesn't complete that job on the plane, the authorities will put him in jail for the rest of his life. So it's a hell of a risk.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, something that comes up again and again in this movie is just like, yeah, he doesn't know. He's got to take it on faith that, like, this will work and that he's going to get to see his kids again. And it's something that a lot of characters mention. It's this kind of recurring, like you said, line that keeps getting repeated. And there are moments when it is kind of portrayed that, like, hey, maybe taking a leap of faith is a dangerous, difficult thing, because Moll, like you mentioned before, literally takes a leap of faith that she is still dreaming.
Yeah,
like a literal leap. And, you know, so that's a negative leap of faith, and he doesn't take that leap. And I think the movie I have the interpretation that he does get back to his kids in the end and everything, but you can take the interpretation that the entire movie is a dream and that Moll was right, and then they were still dreaming and she got back to her kids. So it's there's all these different lenses you can look through the movie. But as a viewer, you even have to take a leap of faith that what you are being shown is the kind of true story, and that he is getting back to his kids at the end.
Episode 48 was another in the replay series. It was with Derek McDuff. We did two back in 2022 with him, discussing two Christopher Nolan films. The first one was Inception, which we covered in episode 47. And this one, episode 48, discusses the movie Interstellar. And we also talk about lots of other things to do with TV and music and other films. Really good episode. Thanks to Derek McDuff.
In episode 5, I talked to Derek McDuff again about parent-child separation in the movies. This time we discussed Interstellar. We also branched off to talk about other films. It's a little bit like Inception in that it plays with time and space, but it's about a father trying to get back to his children. In this case, it's like Inception, he's got two children, but for some reason in Interstellar, he's much closer to the daughter than the son.
He really does not care about Tom at all. Like, he's like, I gotta get back to save Marv, my daughter. I'm like, I guess you don't care about Timothée Chalamet / Casey Affleck, which, I mean... was like, all right, I guess I'm like, is it just because she's like, you know, a brilliant scientist and he's just wants to be a dumb farmer? Like, he's really, he really loves Murph. And he's like, oh yeah, and Tom also, I guess.
Coop has to go, and Murph is pretty distraught about this. And she says to him, you know, go, if you're leaving, just go. And he's saying, I don't want to leave like this, but he has to go. And she won't say goodbye. And it's really a touching scene. You know, he gets in his car and he's driving off, and you know, he's got tears in his eyes as he's doing that. At that stage, Murph changes her mind and rushes out to say goodbye to her dad, but he's gone. And just after that, he's got a pile of junk in his front seat, his passenger seat, and he looks under there because he's hoping that Murph has hidden under there, because earlier in the film she does hide under that junk, and he's kind of looks under there hoping that she's there, but she's not. And so neither of them get to say goodbye to each other properly. He does explain to Murph before he goes, when I come back we might be the same age because of the way that time works in space. And that really upsets Murph, because you know, as a child of maybe eight, to think, you know, somebody of, I don't know how old Coop's supposed to be, 40 or something, that is an eternity to an eight-year-old. They can't imagine being 16, you know. So they probably see a 40-year-old as an old man, and they just can't, the thought of not seeing your parent for that long, it's really hard for her.
One thing that I was thinking of is, you know, in watching this movie, they're always talking about, like, okay, he had decided to leave his kids and to kind of like save the world or whatever, and like Michael Caine is able to convince him, is like, you got to go so that your kids will have a future, so that they will be able to survive and stuff like that. And me not having kids, I feel like it definitely hits differently than for someone who does, because I've talked to people like, oh, I wouldn't be able to leave my kids. And, you know, at the end, I'm kind of jumping ahead forward, but like Matt Damon, who is, you know, kind of despicable in this movie, but he is a really interesting quote unquote villain, because he is right about a lot of stuff. And he's like, the love that you have, like, it doesn't extend to beyond the whole human race. Like, you will do anything for your kids, but you won't like make the sacrifice of like not seeing them again so that you can save all of humanity, or like make sure that humans survive with this plan B. And it's that kind of emotion versus logic thing that I think is really interesting, that this movie plays with a lot, and the power of just like kind of love. And how one thing people ding this movie for is the way that they're kind of like, oh yeah, well, love is kind of the ultimate answer, and that's not really built up. But I think it is built up through the entire film, and that way love kind of transcends time and dimensions and gravity and everything else is such a cool thing. Yeah. Basically telling Brand, your father died, I'm just going to tell you because nobody else is going to. Then she's about to turn off the message, and she stops and she says to the younger Brand, did you know? Like, did you know about this lie?
As I say, I don't know whether Christopher Nolan has a history of seeing somebody separated from the kids, or it may be just that the way he works, it might be that he's separated from his kids while he's making films. I don't know.
That might be it, you know.
I mean, there's lots of professional like actors, they go away from their children, sports players, you know, tennis players, or people that are on some sort of, you know, golf circuit or whatever. Yeah, lots of jobs involve you from being away from your children. So it may just be something like that. He may have just been missing his children, and it seeped into the script.
Yeah, I mean, it's something you hear about a lot. Like, I was listening to some interview with Bob Odenkirk, and he was talking about, you know, not sure if he wanted to do Better Call Saul when it was starting, because he had missed a lot of his kids' time being on Breaking Bad, and he's like, I don't know if I want to go through this again and do the Better Call Saul and be, you know, away for, you know, 6 months of the year and stuff. So yeah, it's definitely something that a lot of these professionals, whether it be athletes or directors or actors, have to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned Trevor Horn earlier. I talk about him a lot. He's an absolute hero of mine musically. I heard an interview with him where they said, oh, so what are you up to these days? And he said, well, one of the most important things is being a parent. And this was, I heard the interview maybe 10 years ago, and I thought, but his records are far more important than that, because, you know, he's leaving them behind for the whole world. You know, he makes these fantastic records nobody else could make. And, you know, being a parent, anyone can do that. But again, I was talking from a perspective of just not having any clue. For me, at that stage, records were the most important thing. Music was the most important thing. Mm-hmm. So to hear that, and what you say about Bob Odenkirk, I'd be thinking, go make Better Call Saul, forget the kids.
Episode 49 was me discussing the idea of accountability and whether there is any in family law. I think a lot of the problems are outside the courts with experts and people who feed into the courts. The computer industry has a term, rubbish in, rubbish out. If you feed junk into a court, you're likely going to get junk out of a court. Courts can only work with what they're given, and much of the problem is outside of the courtroom, in my view. Most systems in the world, family law being an exception, measure outcomes and are improved over time using this feedback loop. The family court does not track outcomes, so nobody knows if decisions made are good or bad. The malicious and inept can make their way into the family law system, affecting hundreds of families for decades, with little or no scrutiny or tracking of outcomes. Family law is flaw after flaw. As parents, we're accountable to our children, rightly so. But the courts, who may have given bad decisions affecting the children, aren't accountable. This includes the laughably termed guardians. What a joke. And I know many of you will share my view there. They need to get rid of that term right now. It's an insult. With some of the guardians I've met, it's like looking at a pothole and calling it the Grand Canyon. You might as well call them clowns. I'm not saying we do that. I'm not saying it fits, but it fits as much as calling them guardians in most cases. There will be exceptions, but in most cases. Courts, guardians, lawyers, and experts cannot evidence their decisions are good. So how can they prove they aren't incompetent and harming kids? Who do you go to in 5 or 10 years if there's damage done to you or your kids over that period as a result of a court decision? The family court needs to track outcomes and be accountable for them. That would be a strong force in changing the system for the better. All systems can be measured in some form. To not do this is reckless and detrimental to families. Okay, so that's episodes 41 to 49. Thanks to everyone who listened. Thanks to everyone who took part. We had some fantastic guests. And here's to the next 10 episodes. Thanks very much, and bye for now.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Please join us next time.